Hi everyone, it's Judy. Welcome back to the On Track podcast. Today we have a fascinating guest who's the product assurance manager for SOFIA Space Missions Operations. He works with USRA, which is a subcontractor to NASA Ames Research Center up in Mountain View, California. This gentleman has a background as both a physicist and an instrumentation engineer, and he's doing incredible things to help SOFIA, which is in the sight of a 747, pointing up at the skies and capturing unprecedented images of space. You're gonna learn about how all the high science that he's involved in really trickles down to people that are in the trenches every day, engineers like you. I think you're really gonna enjoy this podcast with Mr. Zahir Ali. Welcome to Altium's On Track podcast, where we talk to leaders about PCB design, tackling subjects ranging from schematic capture all the way to the manufacturing floor. I'm your host, Judy Warner. Please listen in every week and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all your favorite podcast apps. And be sure to check out the show notes at altium.com/podcast, where you can find great resources and multiple ways to connect with us on social media. Well, hi, Zahir. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure and privilege to have you with us on the On Track podcast today.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
So you and I met up at DesignCon. Was it just been a week? It seems like it's been a couple of weeks, but
not very long at all.
I know. So I snatched you right away because I attended your keynote at DesignCon talking about SOFIA and all of that. But before we jump into all that kind of good stuff that I think our listeners are going to love, tell us a little bit about your background and education and how you got to come to work on SOFIA.
So I'm a physicist by training. I went to school, majored in physics, but took a tremendous amount of engineering classes, a lot of EE all the way through graduate level. Electrical engineering and nuclear engineering as well. Then went to grad school, thought about getting a PhD, but kind of left with the consolation prize instead, and instead went and got a job. I worked at the Nevada test site. That contract covers operations at the test site and different types of diagnostic and operational support for Los Alamos, Livermore, and other national security entities, the usual three-letter companies, of course, included in that. And then, you know, the opportunity came along. A program on that side was winding down, and some mentors connected me with somebody, a lady named Helen Hall, who had been a program manager for many years in the weapons testing world, who had gone over to NASA and said, you know, she's got this cool program that's ramping up, and they need people like you. So I had a chat, and you know, what young geek doesn't want to go work for NASA
right?
at some point in his life?
Truly.
And, you know, we all grow up. One of the first things we do is lie there on the grass in awe of the clouds. And then one night we walk outside and are struck, dumbstruck perhaps, by our view of the stars. Or perhaps it's a, you know, harvest moonrise where the moon looks as big as a basketball and almost as orange. So, you know, I had a passion for astronomy and space exploration and really, as Roddenberry always called it, the final frontier. And so I came along, and it's been 10 amazing years working for a company called USRA on the NASA SOFIA program. We're contractors. USRA was created to handle the moon rocks way back when we first did a lunar sample return in the Apollo program, because it was decided that no single institution should have custody or control over what is really a resource for humanity, the moon rocks. So an association of universities was formed, hence University Space Research Association, to create the Lunar Planetary Institute. And over the years, USRA has done a variety of different work for NASA and other organizations around space research.
So when we were talking yesterday, you were saying that USRA and your work with NASA, that you actually get to sort of occupy a seat at NASA, right? Working at the Ames NASA Ames.
Yes. So USRA on SOFIA, we operate as an integrated program. So we sit right alongside our civil servant customers and our other customers, which are scientists in the general science community. So I sit here on site at NASA Ames, pretty amazing place to work. It's one of those real privileges because I came here as a boy on field trips from where I lived in the Bay Area, and then as a undergraduate student worked on Mission to Mars projects that were funded at my university, Cal, that were funded by NASA Ames, and we got to come down here and present what we had developed and get feedback. And then, you know, so many years, it seems like every 15 years I end up somehow working on or around Ames. And so then to be here is a real privilege. And what it is that it's an amazing place where everything is going on from operations to pure science to developing the next generation of instrumentation that's going to fly in space.
So exciting. I'm super jealous. Like you, I think most kids, but I'm a kid of the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, I watched Apollo 11 touchdown. In fact, I'm such a space geek that I watched the Neil Armstrong story on Netflix the other night all by myself. So,
they've made a couple of great movies about him recently.
Yeah. So this
First
one is
Man was really good.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one. There's a new one on Netflix that sort of like a documentary, really, like of the whole trajectory of his education career from test pilot, you know, all the way to his passing, and footage is unbelievable and really fun. So anyways, I think that all of us in this career, we definitely have that little inner space geek in us. So, which is why I enjoyed your talk at DesignCon so much. Why don't you touch on that real quick? Tell our audience what it was that you were presenting at DesignCon.
So at DesignCon, I was asked to create a discussion that would provide some insight into what devices, everything on the scale of chip design itself, all the way up to board design, integrated systems, all the way to component and systems of component level, and how that is interesting. And relevant in fields outside of the development of those items. And my history in both Homeland Security and now Airborne Astronomy kind of lends itself to that discussion. I chose to discuss my colleague's work primarily on SOFIA. I'm not an astronomer, I'm an instrumentationalist. So I really identify with the EEs and the applied physicists, to be honest, more than the astronomers. And what we talked about was how, over the years, the amazing progress that people have made in the design and architecture of chips, the design and architecture of embedded systems, of board design, going from 1D to 2D to three-dimensional architecture on all of those systems, component optimization, component integration, has fundamentally enabled work. Now, I focused on astronomy because, frankly, those pictures are absolutely amazing.
They're fascinating. Stunning. And by the way, for our listeners, I'm going to throw some links for you that will blow your mind in the show notes. Truly, I think that you mentioned, you know, this imaging that you're getting, you're getting from space now is unprecedented, right? Because of the technology.
That's exactly right. So space missions are, and versus suborbital missions are, is actually a very interesting, how would you say, they're symbiotic. Space missions, the TRL level, the technical readiness level, has to be basically at the top of the scale for you to want to launch it, because you don't get that many chances at launch. Very famously, when the Hubble optic had a slight stigmatism, it took a spacewalk to correct it. And we were, frankly, very lucky because it was in an orbit that was reachable. James Webb Space Telescope, for example, is actually going to be at a Lagrange point. So we have never sent a human to a Lagrange point. We could get there, but we don't know how to get back. So the concept of servicing James Webb is one that has not been developed and has been, and the developers of the James Webb telescope were told, you can't expect any servicing. It has to work the first time. And so what that does is it means that you stop development on the technology that you're going to launch a decade almost before you launch. Mm-hmm. However, with other programs such as SOFIA, because it's an airborne platform,
right.
It's a 747 with a telescope in it that we fly at night to look at the stars. The name tells you what it is, Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. So we fly into the stratosphere that's above the water vapor, which hugs close to the Earth. The reason we need to do that is because we observe in the infrared, and water vapor blocks 80%+ of the infrared.
I see.
So even at the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, right, some of the most famous telescopes in the world are there, you only get 20-ish% transmission. However, with SOFIA, when you're above the tropopause, which is the point of altitude at which you get out of the water vapor, you get 99.99 transmission.
Wow.
Almost as good as space. So that's the reason SOFIA exists. And what it does is it provides the astronomy community with access to what is called the mid and far infrared. So that's not the type of infrared that you can use to look through your walls for hotspots if you have an electrical issue, or that the military uses, for example, in their operations in the field to identify personnel or for tracking of aircraft, etc. What this is this is much farther down. And it's very important because just like X-rays let you see through material, in infrared you can effectively see through things like clouds of dust to the heart of what's going on. So the analogy I give is that if you think of a lampshade, if you were to take an X-ray of a lampshade, you'd see nothing. Because you just see straight through it.
Right.
But with infrared, so with the optical, you see the shade that's glowing.
Yeah.
And you know some sort of light source is behind it, but
right.
you don't know what it is.
Gotcha.
Right? So that would be like molecular dust glowing. Mm. With near infrared, you can see, for example, a frosted light bulb, but you can't see the filament because the light bulb is frosted.
I see.
With far infrared, we can see all the way to the filament. And that's really powerful. That's how you understand how stars form, how systems are created, and a lot of other very interesting astronomy. What do devices do for that? Fundamentally, what has happened is that over the years, moving from the first CCD system at Bell Labs all the way to now, where we have very complex devices, complex architectures, we're bump bonding things together, back shorting the boards for increased sensitivity. You see these complex architectures that are not just on chip, but on the integrated device, on the board, on the PCB, and farther up. That has allowed us to go to a much farther degree of understanding of the universe. Because all of these images, every pixel represents real data. They're far more than a pretty picture. We can calculate the magnitude of magnetic fields at the center of the galaxy. We're not just realizing that they're there. We don't just know what direction they're going. We have a scale of the magnitude. That's when you can do real science. You can bring things together and rewrite textbooks. And we're already doing some of that on SOFIA.
Stunning. I remember one of the slides you brought up, because I came in a little after you had started. You were saying that you can see things sort of at a molecular level, or you can see the structure of the molecules, or what was that you were talking about?
Right. So with one of our instruments, it's called a heterodyne instrument. It works kind of like AM radio. So you have a modulation of the signal by a local oscillator. We're already getting into overarching system design, right? And
right.
of course, you know, the detectors are kind of the fundamental chip design, but of course the readout electronics, the analog to digital converters are critical. Those boards are absolutely imperative
right.
to the success of this instrument. The onboard fast Fourier transform systems have to be on board, because to pull them out, to basically a computer do a process and then put them back into the system does not allow the system to function in real time. Mm. All of that has to be on board, has to be burned in, or at least FPGA level of integration.
I see.
So all the different scales have to integrate. With that instrument, it's called the German Receiver for Astrophysics at Terahertz Frequencies. What we do is we can detect single molecular species. What I mean by that is, for example, recently, and I urge folks to look this up online, helium hydride SOFIA, we detected one of the earliest molecules known to exist in the universe.
That's wild.
And verified theories about the Big Bang by doing so. And we're not taking an image. We're looking for what's called the molecular spectrum. So this is the light emission that's intrinsic to that molecule existing and having a non-zero temperature. Output of light is a fingerprint. It is a molecular fingerprint. Every single state of matter has a fingerprint. And it's up to us to figure out how to measure it finely enough. Can we get the precision, right? Accuracy and precision are two different things. I'm sure everybody listening to me know that, right? This is a matter of precision. So what we do is we take this receiver that's kind of like an AM radio and shrink the bandwidth to an extreme. We have no imaging capability. Even though we have multiple pixels, all that signal is collapsed into one histogram. Mm-hmm. And we tune it to have extreme spectral resolution. That spectral resolution is what enables us to find these molecules when nobody else can. And this spectrum is only available to SOFIA.
That is just completely science fiction land to me, like that we're there in, I don't know, in my lifetime anyways. Like, you know, when I was watching, for instance, the Neil Armstrong thing, you know, when you see those guys bolted in with stuff that doesn't have a fraction of the computing power that we have today, you know, putting them in a tin can. I was like, those were brave people to get into those machines.
I have a funny story about when
you
I
do?
Met Neil.
You do? Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, so I got to meet him.
You did?
There were a couple of review committees that were coming through the SOFIA aircraft, and I was asked to be there to answer questions. Mm-hmm. So NASA has these very high-level reviews with amazing, amazing experts, people who are, you know, Nobel laureate caliber, top of the field historically, that they will ask to come through, review their programs, provide recommendations, opportunities, you know, feedback, basically. What are we not doing? What can we do better? What should we do in the future? It's great. It's actually a really great system because we're always getting feedback from the best minds available.
Right.
And there was a rumor that on one of those panels that was coming through on that date, there was an astronaut. Now, we didn't know which one. So you know, this panel comes through, and I'm standing by the telescope talking to a variety of people. People come through, can you help me understand how this works, what it does? And so I'm going through this. A couple of gentlemen come up. One of them is kind of short and quite senior, white hair. And, you know, I get going into my discussion. And I suddenly realize that I haven't introduced myself. I haven't asked their names. And so I said, you know, by the way, I'm Zahira Lee. And, you know, your name is. And so the first person, they're both kind of giggling at this. I was like, is my fly open? What is going on? I mean, do I have something stuck in my teeth? Why are they laughing? So the first person who I'm sure he understands, I don't at all remember his name because I shake hands with him. The second person says, hi, I'm Neil Armstrong. And I go, I'm shaking his hand. I have to pick my jaw off the floor. And then I'm like, yeah, that's right. Neil would not look like what he does in his spacesuit on my wall when I was 5 years old. He might look a little older.
Just a little older,
A little older, because
that's
to me,
hilarious.
This man is a giant. I have his
poster
on my wall since I was a boy.
I know.
And, you know, intellectually, you know, to fit in there, they were all actually kind of short. But,
yeah. So
to me,
funny.
he was a giant.
I know.
Right? You know,
That's
he's larger than
hilarious.
life, Neil Armstrong. And so I didn't know this, but he typically didn't take photos with people. But I think he was so amused by that, and by perhaps I'll never forget, right? He said, you know, keep up the good work, young man. You know, I can see you're clearly passionate about what you're doing. And I think maybe he respected the passion, because I mean, he was extremely passionate. He was a very private individual, mm-hmm. but he was always very interested in what was going on with mm-hmm. Space and research, but liked to keep his kind of celebrity in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. Humbling. This comes out in this movie I'm telling you about, by the way. I'm now going to have to put that in the show notes. I'm going to have to put the Netflix link or the movie link, because it really is, and it's completely in line with what you're saying. He hated the public part of his life, and what he loved most really was the engineering. And he did not love being the celebrity, the first man on the moon. He really wasn't looking for that kind of attention.
No,
he just loved the work.
He liked being the first man on the moon.
I think he
but
liked
I don't
that.
Think
he
liked
didn't
the celebrity
like
celebrity that came with it.
Yeah, he didn't like being paraded around, I think, afterwards. And, you know, his family, it kind of took a toll.
Military officer.
Right, yeah. So,
he's a military officer, test pilot. That's who he was.
I know, yeah. Well, anyways, so from, you know, I saw the instrumentation that you showed, like cryogenically cooled, you know, crazy high-tech instrumentation that was phenomenal and all that. What I thought would be interesting to explore a little bit with you today, because we were talking about this a little on the phone yesterday, is most of our audience here are electrical engineers that find themselves laying out circuit boards and doing tests and some mechanicals, throwing some SolidWorks. They just are getting, you know, a variety of things really crossing their desk all the time. And so I thought it might be interesting from your perspective, kind of, you know, sort of in the land of super high tech and high science, you know, what do you see is how, as that technology is developed for really intense applications like infrared telescopes, how does that trickle down into, you know, everyday technology, right? How does it trickle down into the market? And how, you know, just go ahead and answer that question. Then I have a follow-up for you.
Sure. So one of the things that's really good to look at, of course, is a publication called NASA Spinoff.
Okay.
NASA Spinoff is a publication that comes out yearly about all the NASA technologies that have gone out into the mm-hmm. world. There are some very important technologies, everything from the shrinking of telecommunications, i.e., which led to the cell phone, also to things that we don't think about, like autopilot and autoland, which were developed by NASA and then provided to industry as a public product.
Mm-hmm.
So Spinoff is a great place to start if people are curious.
Okay.
In general, what happens is that these extreme applications drive research to be done, because what you can get off the shelf simply won't cut it.
Got it.
So somebody has to go make it. So this will go to the universities or to the national labs or to certain key industry players who mm-hmm. have expertise and research facilities to develop.
Right.
And our programs will get the product of that, and those institutions get to keep the know-how and the capability.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And that know-how and capability, then they get to leverage into other things, such as IR sensors, for example, FLIR, I don't know how you pronounce it, FLIR, which is a company, they make these sensors for everything from military and police applications all the way to consumer applications
mm-hmm.
For safety, and even make a widget that you can plug into your phone and just have fun with. What happens is that these technologies are developed, and the boundaries of these technologies are pushed because we need to push the boundaries of science.
Right.
To be able to learn more, understand more about our universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the backside of that, people find interesting applications in the real world for these technologies.
Right.
And what's really interesting is that the different scales, for example, the folks using Ultium, who sometimes may get tired, sit in front of a computer. What is my work going to do?
Right.
That work is extremely important because I'll tell a little story. Years ago, I was in a program review, and we were developing something for the field that needed to be used in very rough circumstances. And a two-star general got up and said to me, "Young man, you need to design that so that a drunk or hungover Marine can operate it while being shot at in the middle of the desert." And that puts a bit of a constraint on things. And it's the work that people do at the board level, at the power management level, at the thermal management level, with the tools to simulate those things, with the creating novel architectures, taking that two-dimensional PCB and folding it into three dimensions so it can fit into the right sized box that enables us to put our really fancy widget into a package that can fit into the 70-pound maximum pack for a Marine in the field, or I forget exactly how heavy the spacesuit is. But
I went to I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. Those packs, 70 pounds, right? Is that what the limit is?
Absolutely.
I tried to pick one of those up at a hacker thing. Oh my gosh, it would tip me over. I can't believe that our Marines schlep around with that many pounds of stuff.
And it's all critical equipment. It's been shaken down to the bare.
It has been shaken down. So anyway, sorry.
So when you're designing for that, and again, that of course translates into shrinking your consumer devices. Mm-hmm. So many widgets that we have these days, and integrating them into single units. So there's a lot of power in the work that's being done with these simulation tools because they enable us to prototype more rapidly.
Yeah,
they enable us to do that testing in software. And when you get I used to work at one of our labs at the Nevada test site, we would get requests that say, look, you have to accomplish this mission. We need this device in 3 months. You get the size, the weight, and the power capability. And that's it. And you have to make it work. And there could be lives depending on it. There could be national security depending on it. So these things matter in the real world. And eventually it turns into, how can you create the cooler toy? How can you create the cooler cell phone? How can you create the cooler widget for your tracking your fitness or your bicycling?
Right.
There are all these applications, but they come from that integration and work that's being done on computer.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. In fact, I wrote a blog a long time ago called RESPECT, the PCB. because it's all the computing power of those amazing chipsets and the devices, everything rides on and depends on that PCB. But when you're an engineer and you're trying to scrub a bomb and find components to go on the board, it's you're stuck in the trenches, which is why I so wanted to bring you in today and sort of re-inspire our designers and reinvigorate them with the exciting things, the technology they do really gets to, really enables everything we do.
Yeah, one of my professors said something that I think applies a little bit here. He said that God made heaven and hell, the devil made the interfaces. And and to some extent, that's what the PCB is. It's the interface between different levels of complexity, different levels of functionality, and it's challenging. It's really challenging.
It's very
that
challenging.
Layer.
Yeah, it for sure is. I saw something on LinkedIn that cracked me up today too. Somebody put something up, and there was data. Something didn't involve data, and a guy made a comment, and he said, the post said something about always check your data or something like that, and the guy wrote in the post, I'm going to forget it. It's in God we trust, but give me data or something like that. For everything else, give me data. That's what he said.
He said,
in God
That's
we trust, for everything else, give me data. Right. So it can be tedious, but it's, fascinating and exciting work, which is why I love being part of it. So from your perspective, way up there in the clouds in the 747 Airborne Telescope land that you live in, since you do have a background as an EE, and if you were to give an EE advice today, you know, looking at these really complex systems, what's one piece of advice you might offer?
I think what is going to be increasingly important as we move forward is modularity. Mm. Now, most engineers have a little bit of this ingrained in them. Mm-hmm. But I think in our modern consumer device-driven lives, we kind of were a little bit in a disposable economy.
Yeah.
But I think what's going to happen as we move forward is that that's going to start changing. You can see that changing in software already, but I think it's going to come back in hardware because there are some things that are just going to be challenges to integrate. You're going to be limited in power because we don't want to accept things to get bigger. We like about the size they are now.
Right.
In fact, we might even want them smaller. We might even want them integrated into our person, for that matter.
That's a little freaky, but yeah.
Yeah, I know, you will be assimilated.
Yeah.
But what we found in our experiments is that modularity and upgradability on the hardware side has been critical for the longevity of systems and capabilities. And I think what's going to happen certainly into commercial and likely even into consumer spaces is that there will be a demand for the ability to upgrade things as you go. And I think we're seeing this with Tesla already. The hardware is there, but you can buy whether or not it's enabled, like with the auto drive. And then what's also happening is that as they make certain changes and to the software, the hardware may no longer be as capable. It may actually be incapable of running that level of software. For example, the artificial intelligence, auto drive, I think it's level 5 now perhaps that they're up to. And what they're doing is they have made it so that those particular components at the hardware level can be swapped out. And then the new software can be enabled. And so what this means is that you bought this car, but it's upgradable. And this is more than just kind of the hobby upgrading, but this is really fundamental capabilities.
Right.
Which you've never had before.
Yeah, auto driving, that's terrifying. Right? So.
Yeah, we'll see. It's going to be a brave new world.
I know.
That's a good comment.
No.
Because what's going to happen is, I think, as engineers, as scientists, we're going to be asked to help enable and manage really what is going to be a brave new world. What happens when our cars are not just transportation areas, but are basically extensions of our home? You have a bathroom, everybody has a bathroom and a table and a small kitchen in their car. Suddenly, it's now a mobile room. It's not what we traditionally think of as a vehicle.
Right.
And yet it's going to move us. It's going to take us from one place to another.
Right.
So there's going to be a lot of emphasis on interconnectivity, both physically and wirelessly. So those are a few trends that I see that I think it will be fun for engineers to be keeping an eye out for and to see how they can get involved.
Yeah, good advice. I like that one. So as we get close to wrapping up here, Zahir, so sort of from your seat in the house, as we look sort of with an eye to the future, what are some trends you're noticing, or what do you think that brave new world is going to look like? As we sort of gaze ahead and think about what we can expect.
So there's one interesting piece of data, and we will trust in God and for everything else we'll have data, is that right now the average person interacts with about 1.7 IoT devices per day.
How many?
1.7. So this is an average. Okay. So it's about one, a little, you know, almost two.
Okay.
In the next 5 to 10 years, that's going to go up to 10 or more. So this is an order of magnitude.
Wow.
Right? This is a 10x.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So this is going to change things. Mm-hmm. It's going to mean that there's going to be a huge emphasis on board and device design for IoT.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be really intense. Everything is going to want to be smaller, more capable, eke every nanowatt you can out of it.
Right.
You've got to handle that thermal issues. So this is going to be, there's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be really fun. It's also going to be really challenging.
Yeah.
On the other side of it, you now have the Hoover Dam breaking open. And you've got the lakes spilling out. That's the amount of data you're going to have versus the trickle we have now relative to it.
Right.
And how are you going to handle that? So edge processing is going to be perhaps, it may be the most important thing. If not the most, it will be one of the most. Because you're simply not going to be able to pull all that data back to your database and handle it there. What you're going to need to do is you're going to need to do different levels of processing at the edge, at the mesoscale, before you get it back to the central system. So this is, you know, so edge processing, cloud processing.
Yeah.
But really, when you're talking about edge and media and near edge, you're putting the emphasis on the hardware. You're putting the emphasis on the board design, on the chip design. What can you do there at that level?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I see happening is there being a huge demand for that capability, which will of course drive R&D and research.
Yeah, it will be. I can't imagine the amount, the distance we've covered technologically just since I started in this industry in the 80s. You know, what we have now would have appeared to be science fiction technology today. So to
totally.
Take that same kind of leap, you know, it's compounding, you know, it's, so it'll be interesting to see how we face, you know, the enormous amount of data, you know, Starlink's being thrown up in space. Oh, by the way, before we close, since you're in the astronomy world, what do you hear about the concerns about sort of seeing through all the space debris? And to being able to gaze into the universe and do that science.
It is going to cause a challenge.
Okay.
It just simply is.
Yeah.
Now, for the bigger facilities, less so.
Okay.
But for the medium and small scale facilities, and of course, the hobby astronomer, we are, to some level, polluting the sky.
Interesting.
And so this is going to have to be managed. I think that the initiatives that the U.S. has taken are positive. A lot of people are skeptical about the need for addressing space with its own agency besides NASA. But fundamentally, we're going to need to figure out what the heck we're doing up there. There are different programs that are already working on managing space debris, orbital debris, and there are also industry solutions to cleaning it up, which is all good.
Yeah.
So it's like any other exploration and advancement, but in my opinion, it's actually better. We're going to do it better this time. Will we do it perfect? No.
No.
We're humans. We don't do perfect. But we're going to do it better than we have in the past because we're already thinking about these things before it's really a problem.
Well, and yeah, I agree with you, right? We're not going to start from the beginning. We've learned lessons along the way that hopefully
exactly.
we'll apply there. You know, more quickly than in the past. A company that that I had the privilege to interview is called Orbit Fab. They're a startup, and they've developed a refueling capabilities for satellites. So their whole thing is that's going to cut down dramatically, and that's, you know, already being whatever they're in their C round or something of raising venture, but they're doing quite well. So, you know, like gas stations in space, like
yeah, it's amazing what we're going to have to do, and the thing that's cool is the creativity of people around it.
Exactly,
it's just remarkable, and what will happen is that we're going to get organized, because there's been somebody off world continuously for 20 years. That's awesome.
It is awesome and wild. I can't even believe it's been 20 years, but that's
wild. So we're there to stay. We are there to stay.
Yep.
We're there to do more, and we're there to push human capability. And fundamentally, so much of that depends on the scale of devices and the scale of systems. That work is just not going to go away. In fact, it's going to get more important, and it's going to grow.
Well, you either have really depressed people or totally inspired them, maybe a little of both.
You know, I think the more we do up there, the better we're going to be here. That's one thing that people don't sometimes forget, is that if we figure out a way to be hyper-optimized with water in space, we can apply that technology to Earth.
Absolutely.
If we figure out new power sources we can use in space, we can apply that technology to Earth.
Yeah.
So all the winds in the harsh environment are going to be applied to our home world.
Yeah.
And that's exciting as well.
It is exciting. Well, Zahir, this has been a blast hearing from you. And thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all your insight and wisdom. And congratulations on an amazing career and a great talk at DesignCon. And we'll talk to you again soon. But thanks so much for sharing Sophia with us and all the work, and hopefully inspiring our audience of engineers here on the OnTrack podcast.
Thank you very much, Julie. And, you know, good luck to everybody. And please don't hesitate to connect with me on LinkedIn, Zali.
Very good. Zahir Ali. Okay, well, for our audience, thanks so much for listening today. We hope that that inspired you and got you to get your little space geek out and enjoy this talk with Zahir today. We will see you next time. Please remember to like, subscribe, and comment so we know what to share with you next time. Until then, remember to always stay on track.